This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. This week's episode is brought to you by the Friends of the Magic Word. Those are the ones who, through their financial support, help keep this podcast going from week to week and month to month and year to year. So thank all of you guys very much for your financial support and for your donations and your monthly pledges through either PayPal or through Patreon. We also encourage anyone else who is interested in joining. All you have to do is go to themagicwordpodcast.com, and there you'll find a place that says to join the Friends of the Magic Word. But this week, we want to welcome Jay Zugai, who is our newest Friend of the Magic Word. Thank you, Jay, very much for your donation, and welcome to the Friends. And for the rest of you, I thank all of you very much for coming back and listening each week and to supporting us by telling others about how much you enjoy this podcast. And if you can't make a financial donation or pledge, then if you could help us out at least by going to iTunes, if that's the way you listen to your podcast, and giving us a 5-star rating and some sort of a brief comment that tells people why you enjoy this podcast. That would help us a lot and help us grow. Every one of those helps to increase our visibility on iTunes so that other magicians might find this podcast too. Well, thank you again very much for your support in any way that you can help. This week's episode is a testimony to the mission of the Magic Word Podcast. Specifically, we try to present a lot of conversations that are timeless. That is, those things that are important to our community, but not necessarily timely. That means that although from time to time, like convention reports, when we go to conventions and report what's happening day to day, that's very timely in the moment and each day that they come out, you get to hear the freshest information. But for the most part, when we are just having conversations with conjurers, these are things that are not timely, meaning they can be broadcast or listened to at any later time. So even if, for an example, here it is in September, we are releasing an episode we recorded with Paul Stone in June of 2022, and the information that he talks about is no less important now than it was then and will be in the future whenever that you listen to this. There are a lot of great stories that Paul has to offer. Paul, if you don't know him, is a producer of magic shows, most notably had done a tribute to Siegfried and Roy that was at the London Palladium back, I believe it was in 2008. And he has done several other conventions in which we talk about, but also as to his background growing up in Liverpool and many of the magicians whose lives he had interacted with, most notably Ken Brook that had influenced him, but other people he had worked with, and he has all the great stories. When you stop and think about someone who has literally been behind the scenes during the filming of some of these TV shows like John Fisher's television shows and Paul Daniels and others, not only has he been behind the scenes, but he also then knows all these great stories. And this week, he shares several of these stories with us. And because of that, this goes just a little bit longer than just our 1 hour traditional format. So I'm going to step out of the way and let you listen to all these great stories that this great man has to share with us. Please welcome my guest this week, Mr. Paul Stone, here on The Magic Word. I'm here today in Las Vegas with my good friend, Mr. Paul Stone, who is a producer of magic shows and magic events and conventions and a whole number of things. He has a magic background, though would not necessarily consider himself as a magician, but I do, because you got some good, cool stuff you've invented over there. So please welcome my friend, Mr. Paul Stone. Hey, Paul.
Hey, how you doing, Scott?
Doing very fine. Thank you very much for being my guest today. So I was saying you really don't consider yourself a magician. Why is that?
Well, because I suppose for the last 40 years, I've really been a show producer, show and event producer, both obviously in the UK and over here in Vegas, too. So,
yep.
I mean, obviously, magic, I go back with magic to, 55 years, probably more. In my home city of Liverpool in England.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember very clearly, like we all did, went to the local magic shop and... Actually, it's an interesting story because there was a local magic shop in Liverpool, and the guy really didn't know much about magic or the world of magic, but every week he used to get this magazine, Abracadabra, which was Goodliff, you know, Goodliff's magazine,
yeah,
which
sure.
was the only, the world's only weekly magazine.
Right.
And I was just in there one day as a youngster. I think I was, what, 11, 12 years old or something. And I said I was going down to London for the weekend. I was being taken to London. He said, oh, you've got to go and see this a magic shop there. And he just opened, flicked open the pages, and they happened to open at Kenbrook's Magic Studio. And that was sort of changed my life, really, because I went down to see Ken. And, well, yeah, I mean, at that stage, I think I was like 12 years old. And
right.
Went into his studio, which is this professional studio in Wardour Street in Soho. And as you know, I'm sure you've been there, Scott, in the West End of London there. Obviously, you met Ken, and he did some tricks, and I've got to have this. And he's going, and Ken refused to sell me a trick. He wouldn't.
Really?
My dad was with me. He refused to sell me a trick.
Okay.
You know, he just said, no, he said, you know, you just concentrate on your studies, but when you're a bit older, come back, and if you're still interested, I'll see what I can do to help you. And he then started mentoring me in the same way that Nick Lewin, you know, Nick from Austin. Nick was a little older than me, but Nick, you know, was in the same situation with Ken, and we both sort of became students of Ken. He was.
Is that right? Both you and Nick hung out with over there in Ken's shop?
Yeah, well, it was just at the studio. Well, Nick, I think knew Ken a little bit before me, and you know, and again, they say he was a little bit older, but also ahead of me. And I, at that point, I wasn't thinking of becoming a pro. I was just a young guy who was into magic. But you know, Ken sort of took me under his wing, and we learned the same way from probably one of the greatest teachers of magic there ever was. You know?
What made him such a great teacher? I mean, the time he spent with you, or the detail, or the, because he taught you a whole routine, or the sleights, or what?
Ken was, firstly, you know, Ken, there are different sides of Ken. Ken was obviously, he was essentially a pitch man. I mean, he'd obviously, he'd been the front guy.
Like
he had
Svengali
his own,
deck.
Yeah, well, he'd obviously been from Yorkshire, so a typical Yorkshireman, and he'd had obviously his studio, the Veroni House of Magic, and then he went to work for Harry Stanley, Unique Magic, which was down in London. He was his front man, if you like. And Ken was very much like what we would call him, like a market trader, like a pitch man. But the thing about Ken was he was a great magician, but he was also a funny guy. I mean, he was a clown. He was a clown and a magician. But the combination was amazing. But more than that, he was a great teacher. You know, he really, the detail was amazing. He knew how to teach. And literally, you know, when you learn from Ken, he stood no nonsense. If you signed up to be taught by Ken, he taught you properly, and you'd literally do one part of a trick or routine, and he wouldn't let you go the next part until you got it right. Simple as that. And then, of course, he's renowned, as you know, as a dealer for not only obviously having great tricks and being involved with the likes of Fred Capps and these sort of people, but also his instruction sheets at the time. Obviously, the world's moved on now and nobody does instruction sheets. They all do downloads. But in those days, it was instruction sheets, and his were the greatest, you know.
I've heard that said, now that you mentioned that, many times by others, saying that Ken Brook had the most detailed instructions of anybody as to not just what hand to use, but what finger and how to hold it and whatever.
Everything wasn't, not just literally how to do it, but also the thinking behind it, why. And Ken was always a commercial performer. He wasn't so much into the clever. I mean, he was very clever, but he was more concerned about the public and about doing commercial magic and entertaining. It was always about entertaining. But his instruction sheets, you know, not only had the technical details, but the reason behind why you should do it, almost the timing involved. And in fact, all his advertising materials, whenever you saw Ken's advertising materials, it was like, if you saw that, you almost had to buy. Nobody passed up Ken's stuff. And yet, as I was saying, it's strangely enough, if you went, often I was in Ken's studio and people would come in and he'd have a new trick and he'd do it and show it, and people say, I need to have that. And Ken would refuse to sell them. He had this thing which is called negative selling, basically. It's a very clever sales technique. But that's it. He used to make people.
The more he would say no, the more
he'd say no. And there were times, seriously, Scott, where people would go, okay, Ken, well, that's fine. Well, I've got to go now, but I will have that. And he said, no, you can't have it. And I've actually seen grown men cry in his studio because he refused to let them have it. Down the line, he might have done. But no, Ken was an unusual guy, but great performer and teacher.
Now, when you say a performer also, who did he perform for? Was it just really at the magic shop as a demonstrator, or did he do shows?
No, absolutely not. No, Ken used to go, because in London at that time, they used to have the equivalents of things like not just Masonic events, but you know, they had these dinners and lunches and stuff. And Ken was booked through agents to go out and do
that. Was
a show.
Working man's clubs kind of
not working man's clubs at all. No, I mean he may have started out that way. I don't think so. But no, it was more like the I'm not say high quality dinners, but certainly I mean, you know, he would go to nice venues where he would be booked to do the cabaret spot, you know, for dinner, and he would do the dancing cane and the multiplying bottles and stuff. Ken's classic tricks, and he was, you know, very much. And I remember he used to get booked quite often, and before he went out, he'd always go and have his hair cut in the little place down in the West End of London there. You know, mm-hmm. He was very immaculate looking performer, you know. And obviously he was a really, really good magician. If you go back to the time of when he was with Harry Stanley in the Unique studio, there was some black and white silent films of Ken doing magic, and Ken was a very, very talented magician.
A manipulator,
but that didn't, although he could do that, that wasn't what he was about or what he was interested in. It was always he had the comedy touch, but he used to the linking rings beautifully, which is one of the tricks he taught, and things like the dancing cane, which was his, you know, his thing. He used to make the cane, and I mean, Ken was interesting man, because you know, he came from a tailoring background as well. So, I mean, there wasn't much Ken couldn't do.
What made him so funny, when you say it was funny, it was not audience interaction so much, but it was it prop comic kind of stuff?
Ken had a great face for a start. But his timing, he'd do all these pratfalls and different things. He was just like the bits of business, you know. He just knew, as I say, he had a lot of the elements of a great clown, you know. He was... But he always had an eye for that. I mean, we used to do some amazing gags and stuff. We used to do at conventions. I've told these stories many times, but when Ken was a dealer, I'll never forget the time when we were at Blackpool Convention, which of course now is the world's largest convention, 5,000 people. But in those days, it was at a place in Blackpool, the Pleasure Beach. It was for about 500 people. And I'll never forget this. One of my earlier times with seeing Ken. And he had one of the dealer stands. There might have been 15 dealers there, but he had a big dealer stand. And Ken always used to draw the biggest crowds, because he was, he was a pitch man. He was a real demonstrator. He was, you know, he could pull the crowds.
Kind of what we see as Mark Mason today, I guess.
I'm sorry?
Kind of like what we see as Mark Mason today.
Yeah, but Mark is like the equivalent today, I would say, of Ken in many ways. I mean, you know, in Mark is you know, as good as you're going to get. Mark is a little bit like Al Cohen and Ken together, really. But in those days, Ken was the go-to guy. There weren't as many dealers, but he used to have little things like he'd have some of his young guys like me, who were, you know, big fans of his as well. And you'd be standing in front of his booth, and before he'd demo a trick, he'd quietly give you a £20 note and say, "When I say who wants one, just go, I'll have one." And so, like, you know, he'd do it, and like five of us would do that, and he'd then sell like 50 of these things, you know. It was like, look, as you do in the market today. But I'll never forget once we were there, and Ken had just put out this trick, Finn John's floating silver stick. Okay. And this was basically, it's a silver paper tube with a weight in one end, with a thread on it that goes over your ear. And honestly and truthfully, Ken sold literally hundreds of these things, but the only person I ever saw that could do the trick properly was Finn. I mean, no one else. Everybody else did it, and this thing was, you know, swinging around, but with Finn, it was there. So Finn happened to be at that convention. He was booked to appear. So Finn's there, and he says, "Well, there, gentlemen, Finn John is now going to demonstrate the floating silver stick. So Ken puts on, at that time he had a cassette recorder, because the days of the little audio cassettes, he'd play the music. Finn was behind the booth and starts doing this thing. And Ken would come out in front where everyone was standing watching, and he would mingle between all these people as Finn's doing this, and he's saying, "Wow, isn't he fantastic? How good is that? Isn't that great?" And then at the end of the trick, he'd go, "Ladies and gentlemen, Finn John." And then he'd walk away, and as everybody tried to walk away, they couldn't move, because Ken had gone around the whole, all the people watching, with a reel of fishing nylon thread and around everybody, and as everybody pulled, it just got tighter, and so he had 100 people in front all tied up together. It was that sort of stuff. That was Ken's sort of sense of humor, sort of thing he used to do.
And was Ken the one also who did the Supreme Magic, or is that somebody?
No, absolutely not. No, that was Edwin Hooper.
Okay.
In fact, no, Ken and Supreme were... No, that was a real problem. That's where the big problem happened. There's a couple of stories there. I'm probably not the person to tell you that because I did something to help Ken, which didn't make me very popular with Edwin. No, but the book, Edwin put out a book, Ken Brook's Magic, without Ken knowing, and that caused all sorts of problems, which are there. But so Ken's link was with Harry Stanley. But the famous story, again, we can probably say it now because so many years have passed.
Yeah.
But obviously, those days, Ken was the main demonstrator for Harry Stanley. And Harry was a guy, he was one of the first guys to bring like Di Vernon over to England and do stuff transatlantic. You know, he was an entrepreneur and a magic dealer as well. And he was coming on tour, doing like a dealer tour of America, one of the first ones. Harry came over with Ken as the dealer. And anyway, whilst Ken was over here, Ken was asked to go to appear on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Okay.
But he was also scheduled on the same night to do a magic dealer thing to like a magic club in, I think it was somewhere like Des Moines or some place like that, Idaho somewhere.
Yeah.
And Harry Stanley wouldn't let him do the show. So he ended up doing the magic lecture. Always resented that from that time on for obvious reasons, you know, and probably missed his big chance, if I'm being honest. He was, I mean, Paul Daniels obviously was a big fan of Ken, and again, Ken mentored Paul as well. But Ken probably could have been that guy if he'd had that opportunity. He was that good, you know, at that time, you know,
right.
But he missed that opportunity. So he was a bit of a, well, more than a bit of a chip on his shoulder for Harry Stanley, you know, but.
Huh. Man, that's too bad.
Yeah, you know.
Speaking of Paul Daniels, did you work much with him?
Well, I knew Paul over a lot of years. Yeah, I mean, as a friend, not so much work with him, but I used to go in the very early days when Paul first became a name. He was on a TV show in England called the Wheel Tappers and Shunters Social Club, which was like a working man's club on TV with a concert secretary that rang the bell, you know, for the next turn, as they called it, which was
okay.
The act. Yeah. And Paul was on that. It was a very, very popular show on British television on a Saturday night. And it was basically club acts, you know. And Paul went on that, and Paul just tore the place apart. He was fantastic. He was fast. He was funny. That was his big break. And I knew Paul at that time. And so then I used to go with my wife. We used to go and watch all his recordings, his TV recordings. This is as early as his career. And at that time, very soon after that, I had a shop on the corner, like a magic joke shop called London's Ace Place, because I had a shop in Liverpool originally called the Ace Place. So I had London's Ace Place, which was on the corner of Leicester Square there, right opposite the Swiss Centre. It was prime, small shop there. And on the other diagonal corner was the Prince of Wales Theatre. And that's where Paul had his own one. He got his one-man show, which ran for about 18 months, which was a fantastic show. And it was that show. One of the two dancers in that show was Debbie McGee. And
oh, wow.
At that time, Paul wasn't with Debbie, but obviously ultimately was with Debbie and married Debbie, and that's how that started. So, and Paul used to, interesting story, because we used to sell lots of the, you know, like you do in the magic shops, the small tricks. It might be the, I'm trying to think now, the Chinese sticks or whatever it is, some of the smaller tricks or the decks of, the Svengali decks of cards and stuff. And I used to have, you know, different people in to dem it, kids and other people, you know, give them a holiday job or whatever, and they were great.
Right.
Paul used to pop into the shop from time to time, and whenever he came in at that time, he was a massive star at that point. He used to fill the shop, and he would dem stuff, and we could never sell anything ever, because they're going, oh, well, that's Paul Daniels, he can do it, but we could never do that. And so we used to say, Paul, do me a favor, don't come in so often, please. So that was
come in and sign autographs, but don't do any magic.
That's exactly it. Yeah. Obviously, I knew Paul over the years. Lucky enough, we went to his wedding and spent a lot of time with him over the years. I mean, Paul was phenomenal. I mean, yeah. Phenomenal.
Having first met him, where was that? I mean, did you... I'm thinking you were in Liverpool and you were growing up then with Nick and had gone to Ken Brook's shop. How was there a magic club, or did you go to the Magic Circle, or where did you meet?
Well,
Paul?
I met Paul actually. Funny through Ken Brook, because he used to obviously go down. That's how I met through Ken Brook.
Because I thought Paul lived up north.
Paul lived up north. Well, he's originally from Middlesbrough. He was up that way, but Paul at that point I think was living probably down south. I was living in Liverpool. But obviously, I used to go down to Ken whenever I could. And spend a lot of time down there. But the other person that was massively involved at that time was John Fisher, who I've known mm-hmm. John for many, many years. Huge amount of respect for John. I mean, amazing show producer. I mean, he obviously became Paul Daniels, the producer of Paul Daniels' TV show as well, mm-hmm. as well as a very famous Michael Parkinson, who was like the main chat show host for many years in England, who was,
And he also had, was that the Stars of Magic series?
Well, he did a thing called the Best of Magic.
Best of Magic.
And I was actually I was lucky enough to be the magic consultant on that show. John was, John produced it, and he had Charlie Reynolds as his sort of co-director on that. Yeah. And I was the magic consultant on that.
And that ran for how long? How many series?
Well, that had two series.
Two seasons?
Of, I think, two 16-week series, which featured at that time people like, well, mainly the Pendragons. But we had, everybody from Channing Pollock to, John had. John was head of variety at that point. And so when you're head of variety for England, for Thames Television, he had budgets and he had contacts that nobody else had. As I say, John, in many ways changed the face of magic in England for many years, and was obviously involved very heavily mm-hmm. with Paul. But Paul was a light. Paul was he was on TV for primetime TV for 20 years. People can't really, you have to sort of stand back and think about that, to be at the top of your game for that long.
Right.
The thing about Paul was, Paul was a great, was a really good magician. He wasn't the greatest, but what he was the greatest at was he could do anything. So, every week you're doing a different, trick. And he was always good enough to make it entertaining and some better than others, but it was never bad. It was always good. And to do that over 20 years consistently.
Right.
I mean, he was tremendous, but still, personally, I always used to enjoy watching him live. Because he was a great live performer, but amazing on television. He took over from David Nixon, who was more like your favorite uncle. And Paul was, particularly when he started, was this young guy with a tack and funny and entertaining. And between Paul and John Fisher, they had a major impact on taking magic forward in England.
Was it just because that John Fisher had the right contacts with the BBC and that also knew the magicians, around the world to kind of
It was a combination, because John worked for a while with the BBC and also with, Thames Television wasn't the BBC, so he went from one to the other, but it was just John had amazing contacts. Obviously he's a great writer and author. He'd obviously written books, but John had contacts from everyone from Siegfried and Roy down. And for example, he did a show at the height of all this where he did a Christmas show. Now, Michael Parkinson, as I say, he was like the Johnny Carson, Letterman, whatever, but he was the interviewer, the chat show host that every major star was on for many years. Mm-hmm. And one year they did a Parkinson Christmas magic special, which featured Fred Capps, Ricky Jay, and Ricciardi Jr. And I was lucky enough to be involved with that as well. But that would never, ever have happened if it wasn't for John Fisher. They'd never have got that onto mainstream star TV. And it was great. That's what John brought to the table. And no one's ever done that, obviously, before or since. But Paul was around a long, long time, though. So, and it was sad the way it all ended for him, really. It was all very sudden.
For those who are not familiar, go ahead and explain how it all ended.
Well, no, what I mean is that Paul, because Paul obviously, was performing and was doing pantomime, I think, because him and Debbie used to do pantomime, which for people in America, if you don't know what pantomime is, doesn't mean mime like you would think pantomime. It's a whole genre of Christmas in every theater in the whole of the UK where it's stories like Cinderella and these things.
And men would dress up drag, basically.
It's a family show. Basically, with normally great costume sets, the scenes like the ghost scene, the kitchen scene. It's a family. The
and
kids
people
get
yell
involved.
From the audience.
It's almost impossible to explain to an American audience. But it's something that happens almost in every theatre, from literally the London Palladium down to the smallest theatre. And Paul and Debbie used to do pantomime. And I think it happened. I don't know the exact details, but I think Paul was having some problems with some lines, and he was diagnosed with a brain tumor and.
Right.
Within a very short period of time, unfortunately, he died, which was really sad. And he had an amazing run for many years. And funny enough, he did there's some videotapes which Paul taught, I think, which Louis de Matos put out under Bravura.
Oh,
I can't remember, which was like four
Max Mellini,
I think four videotapes that he put out of Paul. And if you ever get the chance to watch those, just to hear him talk about the business, everything, just everything about the business, because Paul was an expert, not just as a performer, but, you know, he literally served his time, and he wasn't right. anything he didn't know about staging. And unfortunately, people tend not to watch that sort of stuff, but they really, really should, because he was a master at that.
I'm curious also, I recall watching a Heineken commercial one time that was in the UK, and there were people in the commercial, and they said, these are people who the Brits love to hate. And Paul and Debbie were in this commercial, and I was thinking, what do you mean they love to hate? And they said, well, they kind of fell out of favor, and it's kind of like they got to be old school or something.
Well, I think like everything else, things move on a little bit, and you know what? And I think when you're there at the top, whoever you are, you're there to be shot at anyway. We all know that. And the British press are not. I mean, the one thing about the difference that I see between the British press, the media, and, say, American. In America, you tend to celebrate your heroes.
Right.
In England, what they tend to do is they tend to look for underdogs.
Flaws.
They look for underdogs, and they build them up until they get there. And then they take great pleasure in destroying them, you know?
Oh,
it's a weird, thing. No, but it's a weird thing, and it's tough. The media can be tough. And Paul, unfortunately, some of the media, you know, turned against Paul, and it said he was dated, and... You know, and things do move on, and maybe he had his time, but you know, they get quite cruel, and so he became a little bit of a, you know, there were some things said that maybe, you know, whether they were deserved or not, who knows? I just look at Paul and remember when he started out, you know, and obviously, you know, to be there, as I say, to be at the top of any game, but to be on TV, you know, as a star TV, you know, with series and Christmas specials for 20 years is almost unheard of, you know.
Right.
So he was tremendous. So, and obviously well, now, you know.
Talking about John Fisher also, then also being a producer of what he had done, and you had worked a little bit then as a creative consultant on the show then as well. Is that something then you decided, hey, I like this aspect of it, of being on the consulting and creating side as opposed to being on the other side of the camera, or?
I've got to be honest and tell you that that really wasn't my thing at all.
You're probably working with Ali Bongo and all these guys.
Ali. All right. Well, Ali was Ali not only worked for David Nixon, but obviously for Paul Daniels for many years. Ali was the guy in the table, you know, of things happening, and Ali was just in the table doing the stuff, right?
Right.
But not only so, Ali was a doer, but he was also the creator. And Ali, you can have something where 5 minutes before the show goes live, there'd be a disaster, and Ali would come up with something with a piece of paper or a this or a that or something, and the thing would work. It might only work once, but it would work for that time. Ali was brilliant. That really wasn't my thing. I think when I was on The Best of Magic, honestly, I was partly because I knew John, he was a good friend, but also I knew a lot of the performers and I knew how to work with the performers in it, but I was there more, if you like, not so much on creative side for the tricks, but more just to keep all the performers happy and to do that side of it. I knew all the Morettis and those sort of people who were there. Also, I've always been a live show guy. John's speciality all the years has always been TV. And I had this conversation. I'm not going to say you can't knock ever what John or Charlie Reynolds did. But sometimes for me, this is only this is only an opinion. You know, sometimes when you're trying to get the best shot on television, you sometimes lose that live, something, that special moment. So when you've done the same take five times, I always think, you know, there are times I've seen it in studio where the best one was the first take or the second take. It might not have been the perfect camera angle, but there was something about the show. Now, I've always done the shows I've always produced have been mainly like places like London Palladium and Theatre Royal Drury Lane and Her Majesty's Theatre. They're all one night shows where you get in and you've got 8 or 10 hours to rehearse 8 or 10, 12 acts, and sometimes an orchestra as well, like we did with Siegfried and Roy. And you've literally got you get in at 7 o'clock in the morning, and at 7 o'clock that night, the audience comes in at 7:30, the curtain goes up, and you're doing live shows. There's a whole different dynamic to television, and I personally preferred live shows. I've always loved and so even doing live events, I've worked hundreds of events at all the major hotels like the Dorchester, Savoy, Grosvenor House on Park Lane, where I literally went in and produced the whole event and literally put it together, hosted it, emceed it, even did the charity auctioneering. But that whole live thing for me was you only get one chance, which is very different to television, which is a different art in itself. So that was really more my game. You know, that's where that was my expertise.
It's got to be exciting and also frustrating. And sometimes, well, probably every time afterwards, like, if we just would have done this or the light would have been there, I'm sure there are a lot of guesses.
You know what? Honestly, to be honest, Scott, I've got to tell you, I think the key, like all these things, is if you work with the best pros, and that's the one thing I learned early days, is that, you know, and luckily a lot of the clients that I work for and a lot of the big charities and things, I made sure that we had the budget so we had the best lighting people, the best sound people, and the best performers. I used to get the top performers, you know, people like the Morettis, all right, who would come in, and Hans and Helga I used probably more times than anybody else. I had the Palladium five times. I had, they probably worked for me 50, 60 times at major shows. And you know, and every time, I've got to tell you, I mentioned the Morettis because they were my... If you saw them, if you don't know the Moretti, I mean, Hans Moretti looked like he was a, you know, like a thug. I mean, the guy comes out, he looks like somebody's scared to death, right? Yeah. And his wife, I mean, Helga, she was larger, I mean, literally larger than life. She was massive. I mean, she was a big lady.
Yeah.
And when she dressed on stage, I mean, she looked, you know, even bigger in there. And so when they did their paper tree levitation, you're going, how the hell? It's not possible because you think she's the size of her and whatever. But cardboard box illusion and then things like the,
did you ever figure out the cardboard box?
Oh, well, I had him do that. I could tell you some stories about cardboard box and also some of the cross shooting. You know, when you're in for example, the Great Room of the Grove now has 2,000 people and he's working cabaret and he's shooting crossbows across everybody.
Yeah.
And you're going, and I, every time I booked Hans, I love, they were the nicest people, Scott. They were the kind of, as scary as they appeared, they were the kindest, sweetest, nicest. Not only that, they were the best pros I've ever worked with.
Hmm.
But every time I worked with them, I had palpitations every single time. Because you never knew. I mean, many times, I mean, I would say I booked Hans 50, 60 times. Several of those times when he finished, when he came out of the cardboard box, remembering that they've had all the bayonets going through.
Right.
And when those bayonets are put in, they're not just pushed in like most magicians. I mean, Helga gets people up there and they shove these things in. And Hans goes in, obviously, you know, as he does, he goes in. And when he comes out, he's got makeup on. He's got, well, firstly, the first thing is we bring out like 6 or 7 or 8 or 9 live hens, chickens from this box. Mm-hmm. It's a bit empty. But then he comes out in this, you know, smock with clown thing, clown makeup. But many's the time, there's blood all over the place inside the box. And he had this smock on because underneath he'd been cut, you know, and I'd seen him. I mean, I'm telling you, but he'd
seen
never,
him bleeding.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, he lived on the edge, but fantastic. I mean, you know, there was one great story, if I've got time to tell you, when he did the one of the things he did was he'd have a crossbow, and his crossbows weren't toys. These were real crossbows with, I mean, really heavy things. And so he would get blindfolded, you know, as people do. He'd have the coins in his eyes and strapped up and everything else.
Right.
He'd put the crossbow. Helga would be like 20 feet away, and she would stand in front of this target, okay, with an apple on her head, and he would be 20 feet away, and he would aim, obviously, at the apple. But no, they wouldn't just aim at it. Firstly, what he'd do is he'd then spin round 6 or 7 times, so he'd be sort of there. And then he'd put the crossbow over his shoulder and fire over his shoulder backwards at her, right?
While he's still blindfolded.
Well, I'm telling you, unbelievable. So, and I remember one time, we did it many times, but one time he did it, and it shot in. And when Helga, when it hit the apple, but when Helga moved away from the stand there, her wig was pinned with the apple to the, I mean, it was so close to her head, her wig got pinned to the stand behind, and she's doing, swearing at him in German and stuff. I mean, there were things, and this client said to me, was that actually as dangerous as it looked? And I'm going, no, he's just a good showman. And then backstage, they're really giving each other. But he was the greatest, you know. He was the greatest. Some of the stuff he did was phenomenal, you know. And that's what made him so special. But the easiest. And one last story, if I can just tell you about Hans, because it's a really cool story.
Okay.
So this was probably one of the last shows we did. Helga at that point had cancer, and so she wasn't doing shows with him. But she came in because we were such good friends. She came to the Grosvenor House and did one show with him. And they were going to do the cardboard box. And they used to set up behind the stage area. It was in the ballroom. They had pipe and drape and stuff. And they'd get in the afternoon. Because to do the paper tree, they'd have to start tearing all the papers. And they set up camp behind stage. So I think it was like 7:30, the dinner started. And they weren't due on until about 11 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
So I was hosting the event, emceeing it. And about, you know, 8 o'clock, I go back and check how they are. And Hans isn't there. He's not there. But Helga's there. I said, everything all right? She said, yeah, it's fine. Everything's good. So I go back about 9 o'clock as the dinner's going on and stuff's happening. And Hans still isn't there. And I say, is he okay? Is everything all right? Yeah, he's fine. He must have gone to the room or something. So 9:30, there's still no sign of Hans. So I'm thinking, I said, well, I'm going to send one of my guys to the room. Just check he's all right. So they go to the room. No sign of Hans anywhere. gets to 10 o'clock, and still no sign of him, right? And at this point, I'm thinking, what the hell's going on? And I go back about 10:15, and there he is. And I said, Hans, are you okay? Where have you been? And he said, my friend, and now it's not so easy for me in the box now. So I've been in the box for the last 3 hours so that I'm supple enough to be able to do this. He'd been inside the cardboard box
curled
for
up.
3 hours just to literally so that he'd be able to, you know, to do the trick because, I mean, that's the sort of pro he was, you know.
Wow.
Yeah, it was there. And they used to, I mean, they had, I'm sorry to keep, there's one more story I can just remember of Hans, which is really cool. So again, another time they came into the Grosvenor House and they arrived there. And they were in Frankfurt the night before doing a show. And Helga says, we're lucky to be here tonight. We had a bit of a problem last night. And I said, what was the problem? So he was doing this thing called the Tibetan cross, where he's blindfolded and chained to a chair. And there's three crossbows that are aimed at him. And there's a target. And there's a clock that ticks for like 1 minute. And after 1 minute, the three arrows that are aimed at him, basically, when he's right in front of the target, the arrows fire after a minute, you know, after that minute. Well, they were all set and they started. And after 10 seconds, one of the arrows fired and it's sticking rigidly out of his neck. His neck, literally. And the place is silent. And the screams, even Helga's scream, there's no sign from Hans. Anyway, he was okay. What happened was when he was chained up, they had this chain that, you know, when it was chained around and this chain went around his neck.
Yeah.
And the tip of the arrow had actually lodged so heavily into one of the links right in front of his neck that you almost couldn't get it out. It was like, I mean, literally, it would have, you know, there. So I said to Helga, tell me, what would have happened if...
you didn't have chain?
And then Hans hears this. He said, my friend, you would have to have booked the juggler tonight. and that's what you had, you know. Those were the sort of people, and it was always exciting. I was very fortunate to be able to work with these guys, you know.
Wow.
So I'm very lucky, you know.
Now you worked with Fred Capps.
Well, Fred Capps again. Fortunately, I got to know Fred very well through Ken because Fred was obviously very linked with Ken a lot of his tricks. And Fred was, I mean, Fred was one of those guys who. He was probably the best performer. He wasn't a great creative guy, but he could perform and he had elegance on stage and in the TV shows. Everything was so easy for him and he looked so immaculate, you know, in his, always. His magic was great and he suffered no fools as well, you know, and you didn't want to get on the wrong side of Fred. If Fred ever got upset, you didn't want to be anywhere near. If he lost it, he lost it. But again, I have a Fred Capps story, if you really want to hear it.
Yeah, I do want to hear it.
It's a John Fisher and Fred Capps story, actually, because they were booked to come up to the Blackpool Convention. Again, this was the time when I think at that time it had just moved into the Winter Gardens, where it's about 1,000 people went as opposed to whatever. So Fred was booked to do the close-up and to close the gala show in the big Opera House theatre, beautiful theatre. So on the night before, it was only a one-day convention in those days. Now it's 3 or 4 days, but it's one day. It was a Sunday convention. So on the Saturday, I invited Fred to come up, and Fred and John stayed at my house in Liverpool, which is about an hour's drive from Blackpool. And I was going to drive them up in my car, it was a Volvo station wagon, drive them up to Blackpool on the Sunday morning. So anyway, on the Saturday night, they arrive, and I'd said to Fred, "Do you mind if I get a few friends around? Will you just chat or just do something for them?" And he said, "Yeah, sure, I'm happy to do that." It was fine. So anyway, so about 25 people sitting in my lounge. Fred comes there, and I said, "Fred, whatever." And he said, "Well, I don't know what to, I'm not sure what to do." Anyway, he did 4 hours of the most incredible magic you've ever seen, and he just blew people away. Next morning, we're about to leave the house. Fred's in this great long leather coat, immaculate, and John's there, and I get in the car. We go about 15 meters, and the Volvo station wagon breaks down. So now I'm in a situation, I can still see it now. I'm there. I've got John Fisher and Fred Capps pushing the car to push start the car. I'm thinking if anyone else could see this. Anyway, we got it started and fine. We got to Blackpool. All was good until Fred, he thought he was doing one close-up and one gala show. It turned out he was due to do like 8 close-up shows because, you do that. But he hadn't understood this well. He lost it completely.
Just back to back.
He got really angry about this. Anyway, he did what he had to do. But in the afternoon, they did the band call in the theatre for the show. Now, that's a theatre where they have all the major stars playing. So they don't care about magicians particularly. They're used to working with big stars. And Fred at the band call, because he was still angry, was pretty unpleasant to them and was giving them a hard time. Fast forward the evening show. So the show's going fine. Fred comes on as the closing act. He's doing really well until he gets to the salt pour. And halfway through the salt pour, they black out. They black him out in the middle of the thing. Now, they say it was a technical thing. There was no way it was technical. It was just payback, basically. So it sort of completely killed his act.
Oh, my.
Which was strange. Anyway, then I had to drive him back to Liverpool. So that was
fun.
That
must have been quite a conversation.
He was smoke coming out of everywhere.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah.
So anyway, so we get in the car and he's slamming doors and stuff. And I drove about 20 yards and I said, you know what? It's enough. And I pulled the car in. I ran into a fish and chip shop, which in those days used to sell fish and chips in newspapers.
Right.
I got a couple of portions, one for him, for one for John. And I put them in the car. I said, just eat that. And I don't know why I'm there. Anyway, and there was this silence and they burst out laughing and and that was fine. But a great performer. It was just, but it just shows you, you know, even someone that's like that, you know, your most important people when you're shining, well, I learned this as a show producer, are your technicians, your guys who are doing your light and your sound and staging, stage managers, they're very key to you. Otherwise, people calling shows, without them, you don't have a show, you know.
That's true. You know, as a producer, I would think you have all these moving parts of everything. It's not just the performers you're having to worry about,
no.
But then, as you say, like the band called, you got to all the rehearsals, you got to talk with, sometimes working with unions, sometimes you're not.
Sure.
Different parts of the world, different languages, perhaps.
100%, absolutely. You know, again, and that's why I'm saying, you, as if you can, you work with the best.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a budget, you spend your money on those guys. That's what I've always learned. You know, and obviously, like, you know, you work with pros all the way along. Of course, the performers are key, but they're not as, every bit as important to the guys who are actually going to stage the thing for you. Particularly when you're doing what I was doing, which was, now imagine, one day shows. So you would get lighting designers at the Palladium who would come in on a day who would do like 10 different, looks, in a matter of 3 or 4 hours. It was like, these guys, they're sensationally talented people. I'm very fortunate, but it's something I always did. I always tried not to ever, I would never ever pinch on and that stuff. I'd always try and use the best people.
Did you produce something for the royal family?
We had not specifically for them, but we had the royal family at one of the shows at the Palladium. Yeah. And obviously, we worked with a number of stars, but, obviously magic is what you know, but I'm a variety man, really. That's my passion is variety.
Right.
Magic is something I fell into, and I've worked with most magicians. I say I'm lucky enough to, have worked with the majority of them, and they're great, but I love variety acts. I love the greatest jugglers. I love I've had some wonderful acts, but, and that sadly is the situation now. We're in particularly here in Vegas, where it's all about star names now. You could have the greatest variety show in the world, but there is a V show here that's a good show that Wally Eastwood, a very good friend of mine, who hosts it, wonderful juggler, comedy performer. But generally speaking, people, if it's not star names, people don't say they don't want to know. And when they're in a show, they love it, but getting them in is impossible.
It probably would have been easier when you were producing a show and it had Siegfried and Roy in it.
Well, obviously that helps, yeah. I mean, when we did the Siegfried and Roy tribute, it was fantastic. Obviously at the Palladium, that was a very special. I mean, somebody even now, it gives me goosebumps.
What were the logistics on that? That had to be quite harrowing.
The whole thing, just getting, it was actually thanks mainly to Lynette Chappell, who was the evil queen, the leading lady, who's a very good friend of mine now. But she was the glue that that held them together without any doubt, and worked with them for 48 years. But obviously they'd had the accident at that point.
Mm-hmm.
For 4 or 5 years, they literally hadn't been anywhere or done anything.
This was after they'd already done their show in New York City, though.
Oh, no, this was after them. This is after they had the accident. So this was after the Mirage. This is when they had this. So I'm talking about, I took them over to the Palladium like in 2008, which was actually 5 years after they had their accident.
Okay.
They had their accident in 2003, when they had the accident with Roy.
But they really weren't performing or doing anything other than just walking on stage, I would imagine.
Well, they weren't even walking on. Well, they were. What we did was, it's amazing, because Lelland Palladium, Scott, is the variety theatre of the world. I mean, you hear about Radio City Musical,
yes.
You hear about other places in New York and other, but the Palladium is the home of variety. 2,500 seater, designed by a guy called Frank Matcham, who was a Victorian theatre architect, and it's one of those theatres where it's gorgeous theatre, but when you're on stage, even the up in the balcony, it feels like it's right there, that people are right on you. It's a wonderful theatre for variety. So they have a royal box where the Queen would sit for the Royal Variety Show and stuff
right.
like that. So we put Siegfried and Roy in the royal box. And for the show we had, it was sold out, obviously. And we had 10 wonderful acts, involved in the show, hosted by Jeff Hobson, who I think is probably the best MC, magical
right.
MC around. We had a wonderful cast of performers. But Siegfried and Roy came into the royal box, and the place went crazy before they started. But just getting them over there, can imagine. I mean, it was like, there's no way they were going to, I thought we were going to do a tribute to Siegfried and Roy, honor them, you know, maybe get a video from them saying, hey, whatever. Mm-hmm. But somehow or other, with Lynette's help, and I still don't know how we did it, I managed to get them to fly over. Obviously, with Roy had a couple of nurses looking after him as well.
Right.
And right next door to the theater, there was a hotel, which was called the Courthouse, which was originally a courthouse. It was literally like 100 meters or maybe less, maybe 50 meters from the stage door of the Palladium. It was a place where John Lennon once got charged with having, you know, drugs and cannabis, and he got and whatever. Mm-hmm. It was the same place. And the hotel still sort of had that there. But we managed to get them there, and we did all the rehearsal for the show, which was quite amazing. Until the afternoon. Roy didn't want to come over, but Siegfried wanted to come over. So I had a guy called Anthony Van Last. And Anthony Van Last was a director. He was the guy that was the choreographer for all the Mamma Mia shows, like 20 of them, live shows all around the world. Mm-hmm. And also became the choreographer for the Mamma Mia movie in there. So the guy's, mm-hmm. I mean, made a lot of money, as you can imagine, but it was great. Right. But he was a choreographer of their show at the Mirage. And I managed to persuade him to come along and at least be there on the day and take care of Siegfried and Roy, because I knew I had enough trouble trying to, because not only did I have all these 10 acts and everything else, but I also put a live 12-piece live orchestra in there. But if you've got musicians, you know, they have to, they've got a line check, sound checks, and they're a whole animal of their own, different animals. So sure. And then we had lighting and everything else. And anyway, so we got Siegfried and Roy in the Royal Box, and when they came in before the show, the place went crazy. And then at the end of the show, remembering that Roy was paralyzed, and the Palladium's a 100-year-old theater, so it doesn't have elevators, doesn't have lifts and stuff like that. But anyway, we managed to, at the end of the show, bring them out on stage.
Wow.
And they got, I think it was, we got like, it was an 8-minute standing ovation, just didn't stop, and they did like 10 curtain calls, and Siegfried tried to talk, and Roy was steering the mic off him. It was just funny. It was very emotional. I mean, Siegfried was in floods of tears. Roy was emotional. Yeah. It was just, and Roy insisted on not being pushed in a wheelchair, but walking with Siegfried. And it was the first time, really, after that accident, they'd really done that. And it made a massive. It was great for them, and it was just a very special time for all of us, actually. And we had tributes from Anthony Hopkins and Steve Wynn at the time, and Cher and whatever. Then we did two days later, a royal dinner with Princess Michael of Kent at a smart hotel. We did a big gala dinner for them. It was very special. It was
front page of all the newspapers, I'm sure, and everything.
Oh yeah, it was. Yes, it was very special. And so again, and that was where, you know, the book that Diana Zimmerman did was sort of from that show. And it was time that Siegfried always looked back and always said it was one of the, you know, I've got some obviously nice letters from them, you know, and for me, one of those, you know, special memories that I have, you know.
Well, did you work also with Joe Stevens back in the day as well with the World Magic Seminar when he was with Siegfried and Roy and they were
I was the European advisor. So
what does that mean? You were just bringing in European acts?
What it meant, Joe really hadn't got a clue about any of the acts, honestly. I brought in all the acts.
Okay, you were the talent coordinator.
I found talent there that they didn't even know existed. So I brought people like Tamariz in, Juan Tamariz, Moretti's, Paul Daniels. I brought Wayne Dobson in one year when Wayne was there.
What a great act.
I remember because they had, because on their board of directors had Jay Marshall, Roger Crabtree, Joe, somebody else, I can't remember. I think Roger Klaus or whatever.
Yeah.
And they were all saying, who the hell's Wayne Dobson? And I was saying, trust me. This boy's, he's there. And I had a lot of pushback from them. Of course, he came over here and he stormed them. And he ended up doing a show here with Engelbert. You know, Engelbert was starring at the Hilton in those days. And Wayne would come on and do 10 minutes early on and just steal the show. Wayne still is terrific. I mean, the guy, what an amazing guy. Talking about someone that's amazing. We have a lot of love and respect.
Even in the wheelchair.
To be in the physical situation he's in and still be creating. And he's just starting, I don't know if you know, but he's just starting to do some theatre shows again.
I did not know that.
Well, Mike, who's his friend, you know, who does all the stuff with him, he's starting to do theatre shows. And obviously, Wayne could hardly, he has trouble speaking and he's doubled up.
Right.
But he's going to do these shows with these guys helping him. Wayne, what an amazing, I mean, for somebody that has multiple sclerosis, you know, I mean, just incredible, incredible example. What a great human being. And a great, still now, a great creative mind, you know.
Right.
Just the greatest guy.
Yeah, I know he's still been putting out some things then as well. So I know you mentioned Jeff Hobson earlier, and of course one of your favorites and mine too, and was known as the host of Las Vegas. And you produced another convention that was called the Event.
The Intervention. No, I did two interventions actually here. in Vegas. Did one in Liverpool as well, but did two in here, which were great. There were smaller conventions. In fact, it's still, it was funny on the first one. I think it's the only time that Teller ever did a lecture on his red, on the Red Bull thing that he does in there. I know he's done, never done anywhere else. And we also, I think on the second one we did, it was Roy's birthday, and Roy paid for all 100 people, bought them one night dinner at the, they put on a special dinner on, and we did a whole thing for Siegfried and Roy at the Suncoast, which is just here in Summerlin, smaller showroom. But yeah, the intervention was very, it was a smaller, but you know, pretty high quality thing. I mean, I was involved as well in England with the British ring of the IBM for like 3 years. We used to bring in some, I mean, that was where we used to bring in lots of talent. I mean, the top talent, and that's where we used to get big numbers, but obviously things change over the years. But going back to Jeff, yeah, Jeff Hobson for me, you know, I mean, apart from being a fantastic friend and great guy, I mean, he great never ceased being. To every time he killed, and he was the greatest host of all, you know, for all the shows we did, and he hosted that one with Siegfried and Roy. It was perfect. Another great pro, isn't he?
He's such a natural. Yeah. Well, of all the different conferences and conventions and events and whatnot around the world, what kind of comes to mind as one of your favorites or...
Well, I mean, I think the greatest was, Siegfried and Roy tribute.
I can understand.
Because the London Palladium Theatre, Scott, it's like, you know, it was always, as a young man, as a young boy, I was taken by my parents to see all the great variety acts, and I was lucky enough to go to that theatre, and it was, wow. And I remember the very first show I put on there, I think in 1990 or 1989, whatever it was, I literally had this big variety show. We had, at the time, Andrew Lloyd Webber had Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat was the show there. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and again, you got one day to put a show on. I had a cast of about 90 people in this. We had kids, dancers, stars, all sorts of people put together. And we had to contend with Sheep in the Wings, and because it was all to do with the, you know, the Joseph and the Technicolor. We had all the very limited space. And I remember the very first time that we did the show is there was a choreographer in England who did a lot of John Fisher's, all John Fisher's shows actually for years, like called Brian Rogers, who became my partner, a business partner for a while as well, sadly died pretty unexpectedly only about 3 or 4 years ago. But anyway, he was brilliant and pulled this thing together. And I remember at the end of that first show, I was literally in tears because the world famous London Palladium, there I was, I'd actually produced a show in it. And actually, I emceed that show. I actually hosted that show. And I remember very clearly, we had a guy called Ron Moody. Ron Moody, you might know, when you remember the musical Oliver, or maybe Oliver,
I do.
Well, he played Fagin, which was a big movie there. And we had him recreate as part of the show. We had 100 kids on stage come on to do this show where he's doing this stuff. And I just remember all the thing of that. And he actually, when you've got like 10, 12 acts in a show and you've only got a limited time to rehearse, people got like 20 minutes and that's it to rehearse. And you've got to be there. This guy, Ron Moody, took over 2 hours and about 4 people didn't get a rehearsal. Because of that, you know, you're thinking, I was going to MC a show at the Palladium and I was going to be scared out of my mind. I didn't have time to be scared. At all. I just didn't have time to think about it because there was so much going on. And when I went out to do it, I was saying how amazing when you're on stage at the Palladium, how it feels like you're almost talking to people are touching you. I felt really comfortable and it was a really great place to do it. And I'm fortunate enough over maybe doing, I think I've done 20 something shows there. I've emceed like 10 of them. A real privilege, I mean, for me. And I, you know, that sort of blows my mind to this day. Sure. I don't know, if nothing else, just to have been able to put on shows there and actually then to MC them and to be part with some of the great acts. And I mean, obviously I went back 3 years after the Siegfried and Roy and I did a thing for John Calvert.
Okay.
When he was 100 years old.
Yeah.
The story of that was that he came to me after I did the Siegfried and Roy thing. He was lecturing in Vegas at the Magic Club here, arrived and I think he came with a 40-foot Pantechnicon, which he drove himself. He was like 96 years old, right? And then he proceeded in the back room of this little bar place. He did his full show, including the buzzsaw, started at like 11 o'clock at night, and they took an intermission break at like 1 o'clock, and I was going to leave, and Tammy comes running over to me and says, John would like to talk to you for a minute. So I go over and I say, hi John, what's going on? He said, when I'm 100 years old, I want you to produce my show at the London Palladium. I went, right. I said, well, I'll tell you what, John, when you're 99, give me a call, okay? Yeah. I said flippantly, anyway. As luck would have it, when he was 99, guess what? He called me. And of course, funny thing, sadly for John, I mean, as great as he was, he started to lose it, obviously. And then this was interesting because it showed why he lived to be 102, why he was able to do it. But in his mind, he could do it physically he couldn't. And he used to have a little routine he had called the Lazy Magician, where he had like the girl dancers, and he would sit down and
tie the silks on the rope. Right.
Well, and that was literally all he could probably do. Anyway, cut a long story short, I put this show on at the Palladium, and it was the 100th year of the London Palladium, and he was 100. I managed to get a load of magicians to do sort of close-up stuff around the audience first and do all that. And when it was a great show, but when we brought John in, John arrived 2 days before, and he was angry, didn't like me at all. And I put myself out, it was a very expensive thing to do, and I kept my word against everybody's advice, but I wanted to do it. So he comes in angry, and the reason is because I've not let him do his full illusion show. Well, I mean, seriously, at that point, he could just about do the silk thing. That was it.
Right.
But he couldn't tell him. So I have the director and myself and Tammy, and we work for 2 days on him tying the silks, and we sort of just about there. Come the show, I'm emceeing the show. It was at the beginning of the second half. I do, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome. I do the whole build-up, and these eight dancers bring John out front, and I'm there, and he's a very strong man. That's what he used to do. You know, he used to pull people around the stage, even at that age. So he's got, at this point, he's got a girl on each arm. The chair's set at the front of stage, at the front of the stage, for him to do this thing. And he brings the two girls, and you couldn't hear it because I'm on stage, but basically he's going, "Give me the mic," he's shouting to me, right? Mm-hmm. And he's starting to pull the girls towards me, and I'm doing this little dance. I'm sort of moving away because I know if I give him the mic, he's only going to say, "This guy wouldn't let me do my full illusion show. I know the whole thing," and I'm going, "This is craziness," right?
Right.
So I'm doing this dance, and I finally get into the front of the stage. We get through it. It wasn't the greatest performance of it, but the man's 100 years old, right? And there, and it's great. And so we get into have the applause. As it turned out, when he tried to take his call, for some reason, he's facing upstage. So we're having to try and turn around. John, turn around the audience. John, turn, you know, it was like, we got him to face the audience, and it was fine. Got rid of the whole thing. We got through it. And then towards the end of the show, and the show's a long show, it's always a long show, this, and we want to get there. You've been there 3 hours, a big variety show. And John, about 20 minutes before the show, I'm on stage and I can hear a bit of pandemonium backstage. And it turns out John's back there because he's insisting on being there for the walk down. Now, really, the finale of the show, we've been there a long time, I want to get through it quickly. So in the end, we had to get two bouncers, two big guys, to pin him backstage to the wall to stop him from coming on. Anyway, the upshot of that was that John came in hating me, didn't like me when I was there, and left hating me. And I spent a fortune. But history will show that John Calvert performed when he was 100 years old at the London Palladium in its 100th year. That's special, you know?
It really is.
There you go.
Now, today, to kind of wrap up also, you have you've been working with something. It's called what, AOK?
Well, no, it's a thing called the Kindness Revolution.
Kindness, okay.
Yeah, and it's all to do with acts of kindness. So I now don't really produce shows so much, very rarely produce shows, but I now speak. And I have a speech I do on memory, helping people with their everyday memory frustrations. Mm-hmm. And I have another. I do actually a talk on the most spectacular show ever produced in Las Vegas, Siegfried and Roy Masters, The Impossible. And it talks about how they started out and their amazing show and obviously how their career built. And then we talk about the Palladium show as well. And then I do the third talk now, which is all to do with acts of kindness. And it's basically, it's kind of amazing. And basically it's all to do with how people, you know, talks about extraordinary acts of kindness that people do, but also tries to promote with, you know, people how in their everyday lives, how they can do simple act of kindness can make a massive difference, and God knows we need that these days. And it's a passion of mine. I've always been involved with a lot of charity shows and raised money for lots of charities, and it's something that I enjoy doing. So come up with this thing. It's AOK, which is one of the few expressions in England and America that's the same, which means AOK. And of course, AOK is acts of kindness. So that's something that's, you know, I'm just in the process of writing a book to go with it, and going out and speaking, I enjoy doing so.
So kind of,
you know,
taking a different course in your life.
I think so. And I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, I enjoy magic, obviously. Sure. I enjoy variety. But the trouble, again, Vegas changed a lot, Scott, about 5 years ago. They used to pay me to put on these shows, and I could make some money, and I could pay the acts well. Now they want to be landlords. Now they literally want to hire. They want to rent you the room.
Right.
So they want you to pay the rent of the room. They want you to pay the performers. They want to pay the tech and the advertising. And God forbid you make any money, they want some of that. And of course, the other problem with it is
they don't care if it's successful or not.
It's very hard. You know, it's tough unless you got, you know, tons of money. But even then, the problem is because they don't have any skin in the game, because you're literally four or five walling it, they don't care whether you do well or not. So they don't promote it either. So unless you're a megastar, unless you're a big star, really, you know, it, you don't really have a chance anymore. And it's tough because there are a couple of variety shows in town, but mainly most of the shows that had all the great variety acts, the Barclay Shores and all those guys going back, you know, those great performers. I mean, obviously Cirque du Soleil's there, but even Cirque, you know, Cirque's having a tough time, you know, and on the variety acts, and they've been cutting back. It's tough, and the world's changed. We live in a world now of big names. It's all the Britney Spears and Lionel Richies and Bruno Mars, and that's right. Great. It's all the names. But if you try and put on a show that doesn't have a big name, you know, you're taking a risk because people coming into Vegas are coming in for a couple, 2 or 3 days, and they tend to go where the stars are. Or, as in the case after the pandemic, where the demographics change, where there are not so many international people coming in, a lot of them, they don't spend money on shows. They tend to gamble a lot and go to the casinos and drink and stuff. And it's just changed. So it's probably a good time. You know, it's funny, Siegfried and Roy, I don't think that as good as Siegfried and Roy were, I think times have changed. They were at the right time because now I think it would be harder for them. Obviously, with animals and everything else, the whole thing would change. They were of a certain time, which we were all fortunate to be part of. And I'm really happy that I was. And I'm delighted that I was able to, you know them. I have a huge admiration for them. And for Lynette, you know, who's a good friend. And it's great that, you know, that she's still around to tell people about it. And we went to Blackpool Convention earlier this year. I took Lynette over as the keynote speaker. And it was really nice to be able to talk about her life, you know, because she's always been in the background. So, but I think that, you know, times have changed. So,
dramatically. You know, yeah, but, I can understand. So that's, so you're going to be moving back to Liverpool?
Well, I'm not saying I'm moving back to Liverpool. I might be doing a lot more stuff in England, I think. Yeah, possibly. You know, I miss, that's my hometown. I'm a massive, what I call football fan, but you guys call soccer. My club, Liverpool, are one of the best in the world, and I've been watching them for many years. I grew up watching them, so I miss that. So I still have my season tickets back there. Uh-huh. So I do, and I haven't been going back as often, but I love Liverpool's a great city. And whenever I go back, like even when we went to Blackpool, I taught Lance Burton and Fielding and all those guys, and this time Lynette, I take them to Liverpool after we've been to Blackpool, and we do the whole Beatles thing, you know, we do the Beatles tour and take them to the cabin where it started. Yeah. And I'm very proud of that city, so I love going back. I mean, there's a lot of obviously great things here in America, but I do miss, you know, certain things in England, and maybe I'll spend a bit more time. I'm hoping to spend a bit more time back there.
Well, as we do wrap up, the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word Podcast. So I always like to end asking, what is your philosophy of life? What is it you live by?
Well, I'm going to tell you. Okay, so during the pandemic, I wrote three books, and they were called Mind Sharp, and it was like one was Mind Sharp for memory, and the other one, one was a fun one, but the third one was Mind Sharp for today, living in the moment. Hmm. I think now more than ever, obviously I'm getting older as well, but I think it's living for today. It's basically there is only now,
right?
You know, and we can all have plans ahead, but actually is to live every day. So my mantra, if you like, is to enjoy every day. You know, and get as much out of it as you can. And I'm a people person. I love people. So, you know, it's great to see friends. Great to see you. It's good to, you know, to catch up with people. But it's absolutely living in the moment. That's for me. Live for today.
Love that. That's great. Paul, I've been fascinated hanging on every word. What great stories. What a great conversation. Thank you very much for your time. Appreciate
it's been
that.
Great. Great to see you, Scott.
Good seeing you. And so for the Magic Word Podcast, that was Paul Stone. This is Scotty out. Thank you very much, Paul, for being my guest this week on the Magic Word Podcast. That was certainly enlightening and a lot of fun. As many of my regular listeners know, it seems like that during these conversations, I engage in probably about half the conversation. At least I carry my side. But this time I was just enthralled. As you could tell, I was listening to everything they were saying. Oh, my goodness, so many great stories and things that Paul shared. And so I didn't need to ask many questions because he was on a roll and had just some great stuff. So thank you very much. And I appreciate that. By the way, if those of you who might be interested in learning a little bit more about Siegfried and Roy, I say learning. I don't know. There's a podcast. It's called Wild Things. And it was a limited series, I think about 8 different episodes. They were just, once it was done, it was just, again, in and out, eight episodes. And what they were doing is trying to explore what happened with Siegfried and Roy as far as the lion bite and what led up to that and the investigation and some of the issues. I think they were trying to explore also into their private lives and also talking with people behind the scenes. I don't know that they really discovered anything new, but it's could be worth your attention and interest. I'm just suggesting another new podcast that has been out for a while. And again, it's one and done, or just the 8 episode, just a limited series. So if you can look that up on iTunes, called Wild Things, and it might be of something that you're interested in. If you're interested in Siegfried and Roy or all things having to do with it, with Sarmoti, that's Siegfried and Roy, Masters of the Impossible, Sarmoti, as many of you know, of course, that was their magic word, I guess. So anyhow, something I would suggest you might want to go and download and listen at your leisure. Well, again, this has been a little bit longer than usual, and next week's episode is going to be with another guest who is very much a celebrity in his own right, and is not as well known outside of a certain area. I'm going to be somewhat cryptic about this to encourage you to sign up for my pod letter. And if you do subscribe, then you know not only who is up from week to week, but you know who is coming up the next week, as well as some suggestions from the archives. And in that regard, by the way, speaking of Siegfried and Roy, I had a conversation with Russell Bruce, who was working in the prop department with Siegfried and Roy, and he had some interesting stories to tell, too. That was during a conversation we had back, I believe, in 2019, and there's a link to that in this week's pod letter as well. So if you're not subscribed, why not? It's free, and just comes to your mailbox once a week and gives you a lot of pertinent information about this podcast. So if you enjoy the podcast, I think you'll like the pod letter as well. It's free and easy, and it has some clickable links that takes you to the suggested areas, whether they might be some videos or whether it's going to be to this week's episode and other kinds of cool stuff. And also lets you know whenever from time to time we do have some contests, and you can be the first to enter the contest because it will have links to that as well. Well, anyhow, enough for this week. Until next time, stay well, get booked, and remember that all we have is the now. So live in the moment and live for the day. This is Scotty out.